Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Gorgeous Reads. Today on Radio Gorgeous, we are pleased to welcome debut author Elle Nash with her book, Animals Eat Each Other. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
You've come over all the way from America, mm-hmm. Where you live in the Ozarks. Mm-hmm. And for people unlike me, who's American, who don't know where that is, please explain, because it is a special place.
Yeah. There's this little region that's sort of almost in between the Midwest and the South. It's very mountainy, full of a lot of beautiful trees, like soft rolling mountains, not like crazy mountains or anything like that. really great temperate weather, a lot of rain, humid summers, pretty much really perfect place.
Excellent. Tell us about, let's just start right in there with Animals Eat Each Other. What's the story?
So the plot of the novel follows a girl with no name who meets a couple while working at her retail job at Radio Shack. And the couple decides that they're interested in her. They want to date her. So she begins dating them, and it all goes terribly wrong.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she is, to me, she strikes me as an interesting subject because she's one of those people that I think normally we overlook. She's at the time living, at the time of these experiences, she's living in a trailer park with her mom, her father, with whom it sounds like she was quite close, mm-hmm. passed away. Mom has not dealt with that well. Mm-hmm. Drinking. She's really left to her own devices. And as a young woman, her own ideas of that are, you know, there's not a lot in her purview. There aren't a lot of choices. The choices that there are aren't great. Mm-hmm. and she does strike me as one of those people that we just sort of, in small towns everywhere, that they're the overlooked.
Right, yeah, and she's on the precipice of adult life with no real direction or guiding hand that's kind of helping her, sending her out into the world. And she feels a little lost, like she's looking for family, you know, so it makes sense that she wants to spend time with this couple that's so willing to give her this type of attention. Yes. 'Cause they have a child also, so it's almost like she's a part of this nuclear family in a very strange way. And she's, I would say more in the lower economic bracket, you know, and kind of wondering what's even out there for her. Like, she feels aimless. So.
Yeah, it was interesting because some things that you really pinpointed are that craving for love, attention, going further, and it was so desperate that she was happy to take part in this family in any way, mm-hmm. happy to have a focus on her, even happy for them, you know, even if it hurts, even if they don't even call you by your name,
mm-hmm. right,
and they give her another name. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
So the girl in the relationship, Frankie, she's the one that sort of wants to mold the main character into something. Or at least that's what the main character thinks. Like, Frankie names her Lilith. And so now Lilith is aware of all the expectations that are put on her. And so she feels now that she has a path, like she has somewhere to go. So if you would say that the main character is, she feels a little bit like frenetic water, suddenly Frankie and Matt, who is the boyfriend in the situation, they show up and Frankie creates this container for her. And so then Lilith is like, okay, I can try to fill this container.
I have a role.
Yeah.
Okay, I can put myself in. And the choice of the name Tell me about the choice of the name Lilith. And if that was just Frankie's, obviously it's your choice for Frankie mm-hmm. to have picked that name. But tell me about that choice of name.
Sure. So in the book, the couple, so the boyfriend is actually a self-proclaimed Satanist. So they're kind of, they live outside of traditional like Christian doctrine. They're a little bit, I would say, like anti-culture, you know, or a little anti-authoritarian. And Lilith in Jewish mythology and general biblical mythology was the first wife of Adam, which generally in Christian mythology, Eve is taught as the first wife. Like Lilith is usually completely overlooked. And the special thing about Lilith in the mythology is that she was actually made from the same material as Adam. So Eve was created from his rib, but Lilith, who was the first wife, was made of the same dust. And the story goes that she refused to submit to Adam, so she was cast out of the garden, which is interesting because she was made of the same material. So if they are made of equal parts, they have the same like wills and desires and stuff, yet she's punished for what she wants to do. So the story of Lilith is really interesting because then we have Eve, who is made sort of from Adam. And there's sort of like a, I know there's sort of
she's
like,
sort of a derivative.
Yeah, it is a little derivative, and there's always this idea that I hear that's kind of like, oh, well, she's like under his arms, like protected in a way, like this metaphor. And she's obviously much more subservient. And so while Eve is still punished, she's still allowed to be in the garden just as long as Adam is before they were obviously both cast out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
it wasn't seen as Adam's fault that Lilith failed
right.
in some way. It was, but in the same way that it was seen as Adam's fault that Eve failed.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, so it is, and in some parts they say the Lilith flew away. But anyway, we should, you know, there's mixed reviews on that.
True. Yeah. There's a lot of ways that the Lilith mythos has gone. And I think one thing that when I first learned about it that intrigued me was that Lilith is also seen as sort of like a demon, like someone who makes men succumb to certain things, or I know that some just the word Lilith or like the root word of it has been come to be associated with like female demons and stuff. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. yeah, it's really interesting.
Yes, it's an interesting character, and it's to me it was sort of one of the ways in which she was entrapped in this relationship with them, because it's a powerful name in a powerless relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of, you know, like that idea of powerfulness without the actual powerfulness.
Yeah. And I think if you looked at the story through the lens of Adam and Eve and Lilith, it's almost like, so in the grand scheme of things, who was the first woman? Well, who was the narrative? That's how you determine who that first woman is. You know, it's not good or bad. It just is how people see it. So, yeah.
Mm. And she gets further enmeshed with them. She's sort of, she's as obsessed with them as she wants them to be with her.
Mm.
She just wants to be held in some way,
yeah.
emotionally.
Mm.
But meanwhile, things are getting pretty messy, pretty, and she's sort of using the same approach with them individually as she is as a couple. Tell me a little bit about the dynamics, and there's some other people around. Tell me as much as you can, as you want to reveal of the dynamics of what's going on.
Sure. So one thing that I really wanted to explore was how sometimes when women become new friends, they can get very close very fast. But I think sometimes also those relationships can be really, they get really toxic really fast. And I think that's because we tend, not everyone, but some, we tend to make ourselves more vulnerable much more easily. There's like an intimacy that exists between female friendships that doesn't exist on our counterpart side. And it becomes so much more entwined because there's this emotional sense and there's this physical sense when you're attracted to women. And because you let yourself become so vulnerable, when things go bad, it really does cut you really deep. On the same token, she also is attracted to men. And so that power, I wanted to demonstrate how that power dynamic was different because she tries to gain some power over Frankie, and sometimes she thinks that she succeeds at it. But with Matt, the man, she doesn't let him, well, he doesn't let her have any power at all, and she kind of just accepts that for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that she doesn't truly attempt to change in that way.
Yeah.
There's also an interesting thing. It always interests me when my stereotypes are overturned.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it seems like that they're in a place, you know, the same sort of forgotten people, but they're in a place where, you know, certain cultural things and norms have filtered in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, like you were saying, it is a very Christian area.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and there is that assumption around it. I mean, there's nothing explicit, but there is that assumption around it. And
mm-hmm.
that is a stereotype from that side.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see that certain things like, even just tattoos, the idea of Satanism, the idea of bondage and discipline, you know, has filtered in and become sort of a part of their lives. Tell me about, because there is a tension created there just by observing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you could talk a little bit about that and what sort of ideas you have around that.
Sure. Well, I think if you go to... Okay, so I lived in Colorado for a while, and when I first moved to Arkansas, I moved to a much smaller town than I'd ever, like, much, much smaller town than I'd ever lived in before, and I think it's technically considered as part of the Bible Belt, and what I found really interesting about it was there were a lot of very, very unique counterculture people that thrived and existed there. And I think that's partly because the traditional pressures are so strong and individualism is also so strong in America that it has to come out. And it comes out in these little cultural niches. So like tattoos and piercings. So like these ideas of Satanism, which isn't actually about worshiping Satan. It's more about like protesting traditional religion in a lot of ways. These sorts of things really do, they pop up, and then the people who find each other create really strong community. There are really strong LGBT networks that exist, like in the rural South, you just have to find them, and then they really do band together very strongly. Mm-hmm. Those sorts of things. I think it's kind of like when you put like pressure on a diamond, basically, like these outside cultural forces exist. Some people are going to push back. You know, some people don't, and they kind of live their lives whatever way feels most comfortable for them, but some people prefer to push back, and they find that to be the best way to live, yeah.
Mm. That's why I'm always amazed, you know, I mean, I grew up in New York, but then, you know, just anywhere you go, there is culture everywhere.
Yeah.
And all those stereotypes always get overturned, although they do exist as well,
mm-hmm.
Which sort of makes one hopeful. Especially at the moment.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. I know.
But this is not... I want to talk about the structure of the book a little bit because this is not a coming-of-age story. And it's not a coming-of-age story because it is in the past.
Hmm.
I mean, it's largely in the present, but there are clues that this is in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Things that just little things that we find about later.
Right.
Or that the perspective is just later.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that structure and that choice.
Sure. Well, I think when I was initially writing it, I wasn't thinking of it being anything like coming of age or just anything at all. I was just kind of writing. I also didn't really know how to write a novel. I just kind of started and kept going, you know? But as I was working my way through it, one thing that I really did feel passionate about was I didn't necessarily know if I wanted her to like learn something from the situation, or really I wanted the reader to decide for themselves how they felt about her journey. Because oftentimes when people are enmeshed in bad patterns, bad relationships, or addictions, I mean, it takes a lot before a person can change, or sometimes they just never do. Like, sometimes even, people just don't change. Yeah,
or even see it, right. Let alone change it or not.
Yeah, and I don't like neat and tidy endings. I think I'm that person that people say, they're like, why are you watching this sad movie? Or, like, I love, like, sad music, and I think people kind of, they see that about me, where I can be kind of melancholy about things, and I think that's just because I like to accept that sometimes things just don't get better for people, and so that really did influence where I was going with the narrative arc in the book. So I have heard some people say they felt that the ending was really like left open, that there wasn't any closure. But I think often like in life there isn't, like you have to forge it for yourself. And so I wanted to sort of mimic that in the novel. Mm.
Well, it's interesting because I did not feel that there was no closure, but that might be because I'm also accepting of
yeah, I think it depends on like just if it's not who you tidy are. Here. Yeah, and like how you read it. So
I guess it says something about us. Anyway. And so tell me how you say you didn't know how to write a novel, or that you were even writing one when you embarked upon this process. However, you were the founding editor of Witchcraft magazine, mm-hmm. and editor of Hobart Pulp.
Yeah.
Tell us about those and how tell us about your writing journey, what's drawn you to it, and sure. Was it through reading or however?
Yeah. Where to begin? I didn't start taking fiction writing seriously until probably about 2012. Like, I'd always written poems and prose and all kinds of things like that, but I didn't think that you could actually publish stuff until that, which isn't very long ago. I don't know why, it just never occurred. Like, I knew you could publish a book, but I never thought you could, like, publish in literary journals or that sort of thing. I just was never exposed to it. But I took a writing workshop with Tom Spanbauer, who is the teacher of Chuck Palahniuk, who wrote Fight Club. And that was kind of where I learned, I'm like, you can write short stories? Like, you can submit these places and like people will publish them and people will read them, you know? And I sort of started taking the craft of writing a lot more seriously then and threw myself into it. Just trying to learn fiction, because I came from a journalistic background too. The idea of writing fiction seemed very intimidating at first, but now I think it's probably the only thing I can write.
Why is that?
I don't know, it just feels more natural now, mm-hmm. and I just prefer it because I feel more free to do whatever I want. I'm not restricted by like what
facts.
Really happened. Yeah. So I can kind of do, I can, it's just more free, I think.
You have more control over the story.
Yeah, it's true. And you can change what you need to in order to elicit a certain feeling or get from point A to point C. So then in 2015, I went to a reading in Denver and I met this girl named Catch Business. She's a poet. And she was like, I really want to start a zine or something. And I was like, I do too. I really want to get more involved in the literary community. You know, I see these people running these like small underground magazines publishing literature, and I want to try it. I had some of that publishing experience from journalism. I knew how to do page layout. And I had worked in marketing. There were all these things that I just liked about the idea of running a literary magazine. So we both started Witchcraft. And we solicited the poems and stories that we love the most and artwork as well. And We're still running it. We are, so 2015, so we're in our fourth year. We have 5 issues so far. And it's been a really great experience. I've learned so much. I just am always amazed at the type of work people are submitting. You know, I think, I don't know, I read so many stories, like reading through submissions, and sometimes you just get to that one where you're like, I never want to write again because it's so good. Like, their work is so good and you just want more of it, like want to stay in the story forever. And I feel passionate about being able to put that work out into the world and like sharing it with people, and it feels good that people will trust us with that kind of work. So I've been doing that. And then editing fiction for Hobart Pulp as well has been pretty much the same experience. It's a little bit different, like aesthetic-wise, as far as like what we look for, but it's still been a really great experience.
So now the animals eat each other has kind of taken off. You're off to the Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah.
Which is incredibly exciting.
Yeah, it's a huge honor.
But also writing, and it sounds like you're... process in writing requires a lot of solitude. It requires a lot of time.
Mm.
And it, so how's that feeding in? How's this experience going to affect your future writing?
Well, do you mean like being in public? Or do you
mean, I don't know. How is that?
Yeah. I know. I love being alone and being able to sit at my desk and be lost in my head and work on stories a lot. I really value my solitude. I am a mom to almost 2-year-olds, so I don't get a lot of it lately, but I think actually it's made me a more productive writer, because now when I do get time, like I really, really, it focuses.
Dial in.
Yeah. Which has been really great, honestly. Like it took me, I think like 3 or 4 years to finish Animals Eat Each Other. And I just finished a second draft of a new book, but I have completed, I started it in December and I already have the second revision done now, and it's August. So that's a crazy, it's like twice as long too. So it's kind of insane to think of how much I've been able to produce just by managing my time better. So having less solitude has really made it a priority.
Who knew? So, I was lazy as hell before. Now.
Yeah. Well, I think I know a little more about what I'm doing and the direction I'm going to. Like, I actually planned this time, which made a lot of difference.
So, just learn by doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it also sounds like you found some literary community, which was very important to you. So you have that established as well. You're not looking for that.
Yeah.
That's sort of incorporated in your life.
Yeah.
At present.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And I think a huge part of it was just starting Witchcraft really helped, because it put me in contact with the type of people I was wanting to meet. I learned how to organize a reading and host readers, and began to network more widely with a more independent literary community. Meeting other writers has really made my writing life much more rich. I don't know how I could do it like without my writer friends. It's always nice to have someone that you send a story and you can just be like, does this suck?
Is it good? I can't see it.
And having their feedback has been really invaluable.
So. Oh, well, thank you so much, Elle.
Thank you.
And good luck.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations on this book. I'm really excited to see what your next book is. Is there any time frame am I looking at here?
I don't know as far as the time frame goes. We'll
see. It's not entirely up to you.
Yeah, but hopefully soon.
Okay, so. Excellent.
Yeah.
Elle Nash, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And for more astonishing, fabulous women, please go to www.radiogorgeous.com.